Psalm 108. We are continuing in our Bible study of the Psalms. So start with our summary statement for Psalm 108. Psalm 108 praises God's covenant mercy. For delivering Israel. From exile and enemies. Go over that again. Psalm 108 praises God's covenant mercy for delivering Israel from exile and enemies. Simple outline for the psalm would be in two parts, verses 1 to 5, God's glory over the earth. Verses 6 to 13, the conquest of the land. Okay, just go over those again. Verses 1 to 5, God's glory over the earth. Verses 6 to 13, the conquest of the land. All right, so we'll go to our observations. Psalm 108 is a psalm of David. You can see there in the superscription, a song or psalm of David. So the superscription ascribes it to David. The superscription uses two different words there, song or psalm. And essentially, it means that it's a lyrical psalm that is sung with musical accompaniment. And so the first word there applies to a song, a lyrical song, something that is sung. Psalm is a word that typically refers to musical accompaniment, and it can be with voice or instrumental. It's a psalm of David. Verses 1 to 3 actually make reference to musical instruments. They make reference to the singing of praise, using a term there that actually the actual term means the striking of fingers, so it refers to the playing of a stringed instrument. There's no further musical direction given in the psalm. There's no occasion that is given for the writing in the heading of the psalm or in the text of the psalm. As you read the psalm, it looks forward to future praise when God has delivered Israel from all enemies and his glory covers the earth. This obviously then being a time that has not yet taken place. So categorizing Psalm 108... could be a little bit tricky. In fact, it is a unique psalm, and we'll talk a little bit more about why in a few minutes. But it is a little bit tricky, but ultimately, I do believe it's best to categorize it as a praise psalm. And it would be easy to call it a lament psalm, but it would be a lament psalm with strong praise tendencies, and ultimately, I think the praise part outweighs the lament in this particular psalm. So it does have strong lament elements. We'll talk about that in a moment. But as far as the praise elements, verses 1 to 5 opens with direct address praise and commitment to praise. Verse 6 gives a reason to praise. Verses 7 to 9 give a divine oracle, what God speaks that he's going to do. Verses 10 to 12 then have a petition for deliverance. And verse 13 is a concluding confidence, a confidence of that deliverance. So it does sort of meet the conventions of a praise psalm. It's a little bit out of line with that, but still, I think ultimately the best way to categorize it. It also has lament elements to it, and in more particularly national lament or communal lament elements. And so if you look at those conventions, you could see verses 5 to 6, which give a petition for prayer to be heard and answered. Verses 7 to 9 give a divine oracle response. Verses 10 to 11 give national crisis. Verse 12, a petition for deliverance. And verse 13, a statement of confidence for deliverance. So it does have quite a few features or elements of a lament psalm as well. Another element of this psalm, another minor element, would be that of prophetic predictive. It envisions Israel gathered and restored, including victory over enemies and possession of the land of promise. The result is universal praise, Israel and the nations praising Yahweh. So it does have that prophetic predictive element as well. Psalm 108 is the first of a three-part David group of psalms here in the beginning of Book 5. There's another David group a little bit later in Book 5, but here at the beginning, this is a three-part David group of psalms, and that's Psalm 108, 109, and 110. Now, when you look at Psalm 108, you can see it continuing thematically from Psalm 107. Psalm 107 is the one that opens Book 5 of the Psalms. So if you recall, Book 4 ended in Psalm 106, and it ended, that psalm ended with the call for the future prophesied gathering of Israel out from among the nations. So that's Psalm 106 and verse 47. So Book 5 begins with envisioned praise from national Israel having been gathered from among all nations in their present exile. So that's Psalm 107, verses 1 to 3. So what we have as we are opening Book 5 of the Psalms is we're seeing a reversal of the exile, a reversal of that casting off. So in the exile, in essence, God has cast off Israel. He has abandoned them, and they are in wilderness exile among all the nations of the earth. And that is, of course, their present situation. And so we're seeing a reversal of that exile, which has been prophesied back from the books of Moses, that's going to take place in the latter days. So if we follow along then, and we look at this David group of psalms, we can see this progression of the message. So Psalm 108 that we're looking at tonight praises God for the new conquest of the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and brings the afflicting and oppressing enemies of Israel back into view. The enemies of Israel is not something that has been as prevalent as some of the earlier psalms, but they are brought somewhat back into view. Psalm 109 brings an imprecation against the enemy. It's a statement of condemnation of the enemy, and Psalm 110 celebrates victory over all the enemies through the anointed king. And so we can see this message tracing through the psalms. Now, Psalm 108 does have particular connections with earlier psalms of David, Psalm 57 and Psalm 60. And in fact, we get quotes from Psalm 57, verses 7 to 11, and Psalm 60, verses 5 to 12 in this psalm. Now, those psalms are psalms of David, and they are both lament psalms. They are the first psalm, Psalm 57, being an individual lament, the second psalm being a national lament, Psalm 60. And those were psalms that had strong abandonment and exile themes, even though David and Israel were in the land at the time of writing. Of course, we understand David wrote prophetically. We'll talk more about that later. But they had themes of abandonment and exile, themes of persecution from enemies, and themes of deliverance through God's judgment on the enemies. And so, obviously, there's going to be very strong connections then with that and what we see here in Psalm 108. So, for the poetic features of Psalm 108, obviously, there's a rich use of imagery. And so, we get what we might call a height motif in the psalm. So, we see a relation or connection between heaven and earth. And so, we have references to God being high above, over all, that sort of thing. His glory is over all of the earth. Mercy, his mercy and truth extends to and beyond the heavens or even the clouds. We also get the imagery of the psalmist waking the dawn by playing instruments and singing. We get some military imagery. We get some cultural imagery, references to a wash pot, for instance, references to the throwing of a shoe. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. You also have a geographic motif in the psalm. So you have heaven and earth, obviously. And then you also have, when you look to the earth in the psalm, you have nations and territories that are mentioned on the earth. And when you look at the nations and territories that are mentioned, you realize that they are, the psalmist is using these compass points, north, south, east, and west. We saw that in the previous psalm, and how that those compass points obviously are covering the entire earth. But what is also interesting about the way that it comes out in this psalm, in the imagery, is that it's geocentric to Israel. So Israel is the I guess you would call the locus or the focus, and radiating out from there to the points of the compass that would encompass the whole earth. The structure of the psalm, and this is what I was referring to earlier, that the psalm is unique. So the total composition, this entire psalm, Psalm 108 has 13 verses, and the entire composition of this psalm is made up from two parts from different psalms. So Psalm 108 verses 1 to 5 are a quotation that's almost exactly, there are some slight changes, but they are very slight. So Psalm 108 verses 1 to 5 is a quotation of Psalm 57 verses 7 to 11. And then the second part of the psalm, verses 6 to 13, are a quotation of Psalm 60, verses 5 to 12. And so it is helpful to look at both of those psalms and to consider both what is included in this psalm and what is excluded in this psalm. So there's parts of those psalms, and it's the latter part of the psalm that's quoted and put together to compose or to make a new psalm, so to speak. And that is unique. There is quotation and things before, but the taking of two parts and putting them together as one composition and placing them as they are, that continues this theme in Book 5. And again, it fits very well in the Book 5 theme. So that is unique among the Psalms. All right, so we'll work our way through here. 13 verses. So I'll go ahead and read this psalm. O God, my heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise, even with my glory. Awake, psaltery and harp. I myself will awake early. I will praise thee, O Lord, among the people, and I will sing praises unto thee among the nations. For thy mercy is great above the heavens, and thy truth reacheth unto the clouds. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens, and thy glory above all the earth, that thy beloved may be delivered. Save with thy right hand and answer me. God hath spoken in his holiness. I will rejoice. I will divide Shechem and mete out the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the strength of mine head. Judah is my lawgiver. Moab is my washpot. Over Edom will I cast out my shoe. Over Philistia will I triumph. Who will bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me into Edom? Will not thou, O God, who hast cast us off, and will not thou, O God, go forth with our hosts? Give us help from trouble, for vain is the help of man. Through God we shall do valiantly, for he it is that shall tread down our enemies. So again, as you read those psalms and you compare with Psalm 57 and Psalm 60, you'll notice that primarily what is not quoted in these psalms are the more personal elements, the more directly related to David and his situation, as he writes from the persecution of fleeing Saul, and then he writes from the battles with the Moabites and such after the death of Saul. So there are personal elements in those psalms that tie that occasion in those psalms. And here, those things are not referred to. Those are part of the psalms that are not quoted. But rather, the focus is on the deliverance from distress, from the glory, the reign, the universal reign of God come to the earth, and so on. So, all right, so let's look at this. Verses 1 to 4 open the psalm with direct address praise. And we have this reference to the heart being fixed, and the word for fixed there, it means being set upright, being made unmoving or unmovable. And so from the context of the psalm, obviously, the heart or the mind or the inner being of the psalmist is unmovable in the face of enemies. And we get vows to praise by singing. So singing the praises of God, this, and the words that are used refer both to the voice and to the playing of stringed instruments and an accompaniment there. Now, the word for glory that is used, and it does appear a couple times in the psalm, is the word kavod, which we have seen associated oftentimes with kingship in the psalms. We've oftentimes observed that. It is certainly, we've seen it a number of times in David's psalms. And so that word is used here as well. The waking of instruments and the waking of the psalmist to praise, the word for early means morning light or the dawn. And so the poetic expression that is given here is that the playing and the singing of the psalmist is going to awaken the dawn. So imagine someone arising early before the sun has risen, taking the stringed instruments and plucking on those and singing a loud song of praise to God as a way that awakens the dawn or awakens the day, the rising of the sun. Well, that's the imagery, that's the poetic expression. The word for praise that is used there in the third verse means to stretch out the hands in praise. We get repetition of this term that refers to the playing of an instrument. And then we have these two lines here, O Lord among the people, and then unto thee among the nations. And so the first is a plural, and it is the Amin, which is a very common word that is used of Israel, oftentimes in the singular. In the singular, it refers to the congregation, it refers to the whole nation. And used in the plural, it can refer to multiple nations, but it can also refer to tribes, and is often used that way in the case to refer to the tribes of Israel as a nation. Now, the word for nations that is used here is a very rare word in the Old Testament. It is not used frequently at all. It is used of the nations that would descend from Ishmael in Genesis 25, verse 16. It is used of the Midianites in Numbers chapter 25 and verse 15. And those are the only two occurrences of the word outside of the Psalms. So within the Psalms, it's used in Psalm 57:9, which is the quotation here in Psalm 108 and verse 3. It also occurs in Psalm 117 and verse 1, speaking of the future praise of the nations of Yahweh. And in the last time that it's used, Psalm 149 and verse number 7, referring to those nations who will be punished by God for their sins and rebellions. So that's the only time that this word is used. It's a very rare word. It is not a word we ever find used of Israel. And so the expression then, the meaning of this phrase would be taken to mean the tribes of Israel as a nation and the Gentile nations of the earth being called to praise. We also have reference here in verse 4. We've got mercy and truth, which is chesed and emet, that are used and joined together, and we've noted that a number of times. Strong covenantal terms, especially when they are used together, and the reference here is that they are so great. It's like they're multiplied above the heavens. In other words, they extend beyond the reach of the enemies, would be perhaps a way to think of it. So the enemies are these nations on the earth that are opposing God, and they're opposing God's people, Israel in particular. But God's covenant mercy and God's covenant truth are such that they extend above the heavens. In other words, they can't reach them. They can't get to them. The enemies can't destroy or alter or hinder God's covenant mercy and truth. Verses 5 to 6 then give a direct address petition. And so we have reference here to the universal reign of God from the heavens, and that was a common theme from book number 4. And we get a reference to his glory, that again, the repetition of the term kavod, covering the entire earth, which is something that particularly looks forward to the messianic kingdom, when his glory covers the earth, the universal reign of God come down to the earth. His earth is covered in his glory. His reign extends over all of the earth, and he is acknowledged over all of the earth. His kavod comes from above. It comes from above the clouds to the earth. It comes from heaven to earth. So then we have reference to the beloved here, the beloved of Yahweh. That is something that was first mentioned in Deuteronomy chapter 33 and verse number 12. And it was spoken about Israel, the nation descended from Jacob, as the beloved of Yahweh. The deliverance that is referred to implies trouble or tribulation, obviously. And the saving with his right hand. So the saving with the right hand is a strong image, a strong expression. It refers to strength and power, obviously, but it also refers to the exclusive act of Yahweh. So when his right hand comes to the earth to judge and deliver Israel, he will not be helped. He will not need help. And all the coalitions of the nations against him will not be able to stand. And we've seen those things in the Psalms as well as in the prophets. So when you see that reference to right hand, it thinks it's strength and power, but it's also the exclusive act of Yahweh. He will do this by his right hand, not with the help of the sons of Adam. The hearing and the answering of the petitions shows the covenantal foundation of the prayer. In other words, there's an expectation. There's a reason that the one who is making this prayer has an expectation to be heard and answered. And we've often seen, we saw it some more in book 4, we've seen it earlier in the laments, that the question oftentimes is how long? I mean, there's an expectation of deliverance. It's just a question of when's it going to come? It seems that it has been a long time, and it has not come. So when's it going to come? So this prayer here doesn't ask how long, but it is a prayer asking to be heard, asking to be answered. So there's a covenantal foundation for the prayer. It's a petition for God to do what he has promised he's going to do. Verses 7 to 9 then give us the answer of a divine oracle. So this is direct. A divine oracle is direct speech by God. We get it sometimes in the prophets. We get it sometimes in some of the history books. We get it sometimes in the Psalms. It's not extremely common, but it's a divine oracle that's like an answer to the prayer. So it's like the prayer being answered. Now in verse 7, we have reference to the past. God has spoken. So there's past, and then it's going to be applied to the future. So these are promises that have already been made, that are being trusted in, that are going to be fulfilled in a future time. Now, the word for holiness is a word that it can be an attribute, as in the holiness of God. It can also be a place, as in the holy place of God. God has spoke from his holy place. And I do believe that's the intention of the psalm here. What he has spoken, then, he starts, I will divide Shechem, mete out the valley of Succoth, and so on. So divide and mete out are words that are describing the possession and the distribution of land. These are words that obviously have particular significance with the land promised to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and to the nation from Jacob, in particular the nation of Israel. And we get these name places, and these are name places within Israel: Shechem, Succoth, Gilead, Manasseh. These would be central Israel. So in other words, these references would be geographically the compass points east to west. and he exerts divine ownership. Notice that God says it. It's mine. It's mine. It's mine. These places that he has given or promised, he says, they are mine. It's mine. I own it. We have reference to Ephraim, which would be north. We have reference to Judah, which would be south in Israel as well. And again, these are compass points that are listed by nations or their territories. So in other words, all of Israel is covered in terms of tribes and territory in the way that this promise is made. Ephraim and Judah, particularly referring to northern and southern kingdom, which features later among the prophets, references to Ephraim and Judah being joined together, being one king. I think it's in Ezekiel's prophecy where he takes the sticks and puts them together, and you know, one is Ephraim, one's the northern kingdom, and one is Judah, one's the southern kingdom, and they're together and they become one stick, and this is what's going to happen in the future, those kingdoms reunited as one whole nation of the full tribes. So obviously this is spoken prophetically because they have still never been reunited. They are still yet divided, and in fact scattered. So he refers to strength, strength of head, which is a military term, military imagery. Lawgiver refers to ruling, which that also comes through Judah, which we are very close to seeing that particular prophecy, prophetic blessing in Genesis chapter 49. Verse 9 refers to dominion and extends to the enemy nations. Moab was south of Israel. Moab was outside of Israel. Moab was not within the land. The washpot refers to a foot basin, and essentially the reference or the expression means that they'll be fully subjugated. Moab is my washpot. In other words, they will be owned. Edom was to the east. The throwing of the shoe is something that is a cultural idiom, and it is also somewhat uncertain as exactly, you know, what it means. But what we do know about it is that it's another high imagery expression that's going to indicate subjection and ownership. So it is subjection of Moab and Edom, ownership of Moab and Edom, Philistia to the west. And this is a direction to praise the Lord's victory. So his divine oracle is that he is going to, central to Israel, he's going to reconquer the land. He's going to take the land. And in fact, he's going to conquer the land in a way that they even failed to do under the leadership of Joshua. Verses 10 to 12 then give petitions for God's help. So in other words, it's like presenting, this is the situation. This is what God has promised. So fulfill those promises. Send, bring help. The strong city of Edom refers to a fortification of Edom referred to in Jeremiah chapter 49 and verse number 16. In more general terms, it's expressing a conquest of the very stronghold of the enemy. In other words, the very seat of the enemy's power being taken. Verse 11 gives us direct address to God, recognizes being abandoned by God, being cast off. But the very God that abandoned and scattered will also gather and deliver. And that is the point. Verse 12 recognizes God as the only source of help or salvation. There is no trust in man or in Adam. Adam is the word that's used there. Man is powerless. Man is powerless to be able to subdue the enemies of God, to establish the kingdom of the Messiah, to establish perfect justice and peace, and to cover the earth with the glory of Yahweh. Man is completely powerless to do that. God is the only source of help or salvation. And in verse 13 expresses supreme confidence in God. God will scatter all of the enemies. Indicates that this victory is given by God or given through his Messiah. All right, let's go to interpretation. Psalm 108 teaches the universal reign of God, and that his universal reign is not only in, for, or over the heavens. In other words, his reign from the heavens, his throne in the heavens, his seat in the heavens, is referred to in places like Psalm 2. But his reign comes to the earth, and his reign coming to the earth crushes his enemies, takes possession of the land, gathers and restores the nation of Israel to it. So ultimately, these references to the universal reign of God that show us that the earth is the Lord's, and he governs it as he pleases. So cultural and ethnic claims to territory do not determine ownership ultimately. God owns it all, and he gives it to whom he will. So especially in the giving of Israel the land of Canaan, as first promised to Abraham. Psalm 108 teaches that overcoming evil and true victory is not about numbers and resources. It's not about technology. It's not. There's no help in man. It is God's right arm and his right arm alone that brings this salvation, that treads down the enemies, that gathers and restores Israel, that conquers the land, that establishes peace, and his glory covers the earth. So God, the one who scatters, is also the God who restores. And even though the nations rebel against him, they cannot stop or overcome him. So the messianic hope of Psalm 108 is seen in this future vision of the triumph of Messiah's kingdom when the reign of God comes to earth in the person of the Davidic king. So this psalm is composed of two earlier psalms by David. But also it shows us some of the things we've talked about. It's been a while, so we haven't been looking at mainly Davidic psalms in the later part of the psalms. But one of the things that we've talked about previously as we have studied the psalms is that David was a prophet. He was an anointed prophet. And so taking these other two psalms and selecting the parts of them that he did and putting them together again shows David as a prophet. David, who knew through God's covenant with him that he would raise up Messiah to sit on his everlasting throne. Peter refers to this in Acts chapter 2 and verse number 30. God's covenant made in 2 Samuel chapter 7 verses 8 to 17. We've talked before about the many things that he knew. We're about to the end of Genesis. We've seen a number of prophecies there. There are further prophecies in the Pentateuch that we have referred to pertaining to the nation of Israel and the kingdom and all of those sort of things. And David knew those things. And David was an anointed prophet who wrote under the inspiration of the Spirit. So he knew that this covenant promised victory over the enemies of Israel and peace to Israel in the land, even though David was in the land when God made this covenant with him. So David foresaw the time of Jacob's trouble and the day of Yahweh that will bring judgment and salvation to the earth. And so this then is a song of the true and greater David, of whom the historic David was only a prefigure. So David, being an anointed prophet under the inspiration of the Spirit, meant that as David wrote in these psalms, he recognized that there were certain events and happenings and such in his life that prefigured the Messiah. David knew he wasn't. He knew he wasn't the Messiah, but he knew the Messiah would come of him. He knew the Messiah would be his son by descent. And so the one who is God's mercy and truth personified will come to the earth. We've talked about this recently as well. John 1:14, Jesus being full of grace and truth, and that being equivalent to this statement of mercy and truth in the Old Testament, the covenantal implications of that. So David foresaw God's glory will be over all the earth. And when his glory is awakened and God's right arm comes to the earth in the person of the Messiah to reign in glory over the nations of the earth. All right, applications. I have two of these. Two applications, ways that Psalm 108 speaks to us as modern readers of this psalm. Well, number one, understanding Psalm 108 helps us understand that man cannot defeat the enemies, conquer the land, and cover the earth with the glory of the Lord. Now, that might seem to be a given to most everyone here, but it certainly it has not been throughout history. There have been various efforts at going out with sword and shield and trying to conquer the earth for Christ. There are still those efforts that are being undertaken today. Usually the weapons are a little bit different. But a psalm like this just helps remind us that we as people are not going to conquer the earth with swords and spears and shields and whatever weapons of technology and such. Now, the other side of that is that we don't need to be overwhelmed, because generally, you know, we look out and we see the enemy around us, and we see their hostility to God. We see their rebellion to God's word, and oh, they seem to be so well funded. They seem to have so much power. I mean, we see it in our world today, how that they're able to bend corporations and institutions and all of these things to all of their whims and desires in their effort to rebel against the Creator, and they're able to do that. And yet it seems like, well, the Christian voice just seems to be drowned out, and it seems to be marginalized, and it seems to be having little to no effect. Well, again, the earth, though, it's not theirs, and they're not going to win it. And I know that it can be overwhelming, it can be discouraging so oftentimes, and it is, but understanding that God's right arm brings salvation and deliverance, God is going to judge the nations of this earth, and he is going to establish his righteousness on this earth. Number two, understanding Psalm 108 helps us understand that the God who is high above all is not too far away to hear and to help us. These kind of prayers, these prayers are heard. Now, the difficulty for us is that they're not answered as soon as we would like them to be. I mean, in these days, sometimes you send a text message, or maybe you call and you can't get a hold of somebody, and so you leave them a voicemail, and it's something important to you, and you want to hear right away. And oftentimes we don't hear right away. And we experience what seems to be the same thing in prayer. But we can look to God's word. We can look to a psalm like Psalm 108, realize that these promises that God has made, and he's going to keep them. We don't know the day or the hour. You know, we don't know that timing. So we are reassured, though, that God's not too far away. It's not that God can't hear us. It's not that God can't help us. He can, and he does. And he's going to answer these things. He's going to answer them in his way and in his time. So we are reassured of God's faithfulness to his promises, and we are once again reminded of our need to take refuge in him. And so if you look back at like Psalm 57 and Psalm 60, These were times when David spoke, particularly in the situations of his life at the time that are not in this psalm. He spoke of that refuge, of that taking refuge in God in the midst of that dark time. And that really is where we are sheltered and protected, and where our faith is helped and strengthened.